Welcome to my journeys and stories around the old county of Gwent. Well, I've been moving on through the southwest of the county as summer has turned towards autumn and there's been a change in the weather, in this strange weather that's been coming to take the place of the seasonal weathers we've grown used to. So that the land in this part of the world, at least, the land that's been dried out through heat waves, with the grain cut early and fruit trees heavy with their own bounty, is now wet. It's not heavy and muddy yet, but it's wet. It's been rained on good and proper. And it's my experience that when you're out and about walking the land, there is dry rain and wet rain. There is rain that you can shake off fairly easily, and there is rain that comes and goes and comes again and again. And, well, sometimes things don't work out quite as planned. And I had thought about making my way up and over Machen Mountain and onto Mynydd Islwyn, and to have some conversations with Frank Olding about some of the particular features of this landscape, and to bring this season to a neat close before heading on deeper into autumn, into the west of the county, where things are different. Now, the area around Machen is quite a hub for walking. It's beautiful, of course, and there are a number of paths and walking routes which run through it. The Rumney Ridgeway Walk, which crosses the mountain. In fact, Machen Mountain is the highest point on the walk, and the Sidhowie Valley Walk. And I didn't know which particular route Rambler had taken, so I decided to approach the crossing of the mountain from the southeast edge, mainly on the basis that there is a small nature reserve there, run by Gwent Wildlife Trust, at a place called Dan y Graig. And it's only a very small reserve, but the small reserves are often just as interesting as the big ones. And it looked as if it would be easy enough to visit the reserve and go up onto the mountain from there. And it was clear from first thing in the morning that the rain was of the wet and determined kind. But still, you know, I've got decent enough wet weather gear. And the little reserve at Dan y Graig had been drinking in the rain. And by the time we got there, the whole reserve seemed to be made up of millions of dripping leaves. And the brambles, well, the brambles had excelled themselves. They had taken fast growing to a whole new level. And the paths that would have led upwards and onto the mountain were choked and barred with sharp, tripping your foot, whipping your eyes, brambles. And I had, in my, I now realise, misguided preparations, taken out my secateurs from my backpack that very morning. Yes, I do sometimes carry secateurs for this very reason, but I had taken them out. And the rain set in and the brambles were victorious. And so we retreated and set out to follow an alternative route, which also proved to be blocked. My recording kit then decided not to work, probably because it had taken on some moisture. And the day wore on and Machen Mountain remained unclimbed. And I and Frank were left, as Dougal of the Magic Roundabout once said, wandering around in the foothills of life. Anyhow, I think I've said in a previous episode that it's often just as interesting to devise your own route when rambling in Gwent rather than follow an established trail. So I should just probably use this opportunity to point out that established trails are sometimes quite a good option. Now, one of the reasons Mynydd Machen is significant, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it, is that really it's the start, when viewed from the south, of the Gwent uplands. The high ridges and moorland area which stretches down through Gwent broken up by the rivers that run north to south until they reach Mynyddmachan, where long, long ago, probably through glacial activity, those rivers were diverted off to make their way down to what is now Newport and the sea beyond. And you can see this change very clearly in the landscape. You can see Mynyddmachan rising up, and you can tell that something is changing. Close by is Twm Barlwm, another mountain which marks this dark boundary. And when the Romans arrived, they found what all the peoples that had gone before them knew, that the uplands were an impenetrable place, really hard to get into and move around in, let alone bring an army and supplies into. And so the Romans discovered that the best way to get around is to travel along the ridgeways. The same was true when the Normans arrived. Down in the lowlands, in Gwynllŵg, in the places we've previously travelled through, the Welsh succumbed comparatively quickly, although it probably didn't seem like that to them at the time, in the face of the arriving Normans, but not so in the uplands. And so there remained a stark divide between the upland Welsh and the Anglo-Normans on the lower lands. Frank explained to me that there isn't any evidence from the Gwent uplands of human presence in the Paleolithic era, so the Old Stone Age, but there is some from the Mesolithic, or the Middle Stone Age, which shows that small groups of hunter-gatherers in those days made use of favourable places, particularly on the ridges, to intercept the movement of deer and elk and aurochs. And they would have stayed down in the lowlands during the winter, and on the summer months would have gone up to pursue the animals along the ridges. And there are scatters of small flint tools and flakes of flint which show the patterns of their movements. And there are examples of these from Mynyddmachan. And this continued into Neolithic times. And as farming became settled, the system continued on that is typical of the uplands, of the Hafod and the Hendre. The Hendre being the settled farmhouse down in the valley, where you could live during the winter, and the Hafod being the summer dwelling, where the herds could be taken up into the mountains for the summer grazing. Transhumance that's practiced widely and is evident in the Gwent uplands. Now, due to my recording system failure, I couldn't capture most of Frank's conversation about the uplands here. So all I can suggest is that if you are interested in this topic, you look at his book, The Archaeology of Upland Gwent, which is published by the Royal Commission on the Ancient and Historical Monuments of Wales. And that tells you quite a lot, and it's got lots of good photos too. However, before my recorder gave out entirely, I did manage to get a short chat with Frank, and it was in Mynyddyslwyn, which today is a strange place, a place in the wilds, perched way up in the clouds north of Mynyddmachan. And what there is there is a huge old church, a little old pub, and a tump, a mound, Twin Tudur. So picture the driving rain, the wide grey sky, the church and its enormous dripping yew trees, and a very cramped attempt to record a conversation about Twin Tudur whilst sat sheltering in the car. Here we go.
Well, Twin Tudur is a motte. It's a castle mound that the Normans brought the idea to Britain. So it's an earthen mound which once had a wooden tower on the top and sat within a defended bailey. And it's the earliest form of castle. as I say, that the Normans brought with them in the 11th century, and then they were used right through to the 13th century, and they were the quickest and most effective means of establishing control over a piece of land once you'd taken it, or if you wanted to defend it. And it's a place essentially where you keep horses safe. So underneath the motte there'll be a bailey with a stable and a bank and a ditch and a palisade around that. So it's a easily defendable headquarters to defend land or to hold land that you've conquered. And there are lots and lots of them in southeast Wales, as you can imagine, because there's forever toing and froing between the Normans conquering a bit and losing a bit, the Welsh conquering a bit and losing a bit. And in our neck of the woods, they might well be Norman, or they could equally well be Welsh, but they're very difficult to date. That's one of the issues with them, really.
So is Tweintydir Welsh then?
It could be Welsh. There are two theories about Tweintydir that have been put forward. One is that it was built by William Rufus, the Norman King of England, in the 1090s. 1093, he was fighting a campaign up here in the Gwent Valleys, trying to extend the lordship of Abergavenny to the west. And so some people think these might be motts to secure land that he was trying to conquer, not entirely successfully. And the other theory is that it's a Welsh motte, that what the Welsh are building motts very soon in imitation of the Normans, in an effort to maintain their grip on their upland land holdings here in southwest Gwent.
Because there's a castle as well, isn't there? Castell Maredydd, which is a Welsh castle, or there's just a few stones of it just near here, near Machen. Would that have been connected then with Tweintydir? Or?
Yes, that's the same family, the same dynasty, if you like. The princes of Edlogan, as they had been, and the princes of Gwynllwg, as they had been, became in the late 12th and early 13th century the Lords of Caerleon. And they were the last of the Welsh princes in Gwent to hold out against the Normans. They held out right down until the 13th century. And yes, these Castell Maredydd belongs to them in their lordship of Machen. And Tweintydir would have belonged to them, because we are still in their lordship of Machen here. And so it's quite possible the best candidate for having built it from among the Welsh would be one of the members of the dynasty of Caerleon in the late 12th or the early 13th century.
When I see these mounds, because there's another one, isn't there, in Llanhilleth, next to the church there, and they often seem to be next to a church, or I suppose a church is next to them, technically speaking. I've always thought in the past that, oh, Bronze Age burial mounds, but that's not necessarily the case then.
Some of them, at St Illtyd's particularly, because there is a mention of a mound there back in the 9th, 10th century in a poem in the Black Book of Carmarthen. It's referred to as Bedd Owain, the grave of Owain, and that strongly implies that there was a mound where the mound is before the Normans arrived, and so that's likely to be a Bronze Age burial mound, which they've then piled more material on top of to make a motte. And we know, for instance, the only excavated example of that going on is actually in Herefordshire at St Wenard's, where when the mound was excavated, there was actually a Bronze Age burial mound at the bottom. So if there was a handy mound, which is about half the height you wanted, you used that, you dug a deeper ditch and you threw more stuff on the top. So we know that they were doing that in various places. Whether Tweintydir is an example of that, we don't know. It's difficult to tell. We haven't got any evidence, really.
There seems to be a lot of folklore that's grown up around these tumps that's been kind of growing and developing for quite a long time. For example, just the fact that they are called graves, or that they're considered to be places with a kind of a special relevance. You may comment if you so wish.
Yes, well, no, they're obvious things in the landscape, aren't they? So they invite explanations for their existence. That's the first thing. So they're quite often stories about how they came to be there. There's also traditions, as you say, regarding them as graves. Certainly later people associate them with, they give them a name, Sean Schenkin or Sean Shifra. They will say Tump Sean Schiffer, Tump Sean Schenken, something like that, which kind of implies that someone is buried there, which is the natural way of looking at them, I suppose, in a way. Because in the later Middle Ages, ordinary people wouldn't have known that there'd been a tower on there once. So there's that tradition. There's also, of course, the Tumpath with a harpist on it, allegedly, where people danced on them. The harper sat up there and then people danced on them. So there's that association as well. And of course, that Tumbalum, it's supposed to sing. There's a supernatural element to it. People have tried to explain it with rabbit warrens and holes in it and goodness knows what. But when the wind's in a certain direction, it's supposed to make a very unearthly sound. I've never heard it make the sound. So yes, they do attract folklore because they're such obvious features in the landscape.
Well, up here in the clouds in Mynyddyslwyn, there is a little story I would like to share before leaving. It isn't folklore, but it does belong in this place. Because in St. Tudor's Church, which would once have been thronged with people, one of my great-grandmothers was baptised and her family lived in this parish a little way down the hill in Ynysthie. And her father, so my two times great-grandfather, Henry Bailey, did a brave and timely thing which got written about in the Western Mail. So I'm going to read out the article in his honour and also because it touches on a topic that's been in the news quite a bit recently and has been a scourge in the long hot summer just gone. Oh, and I should also say that the article refers to Islwyn, which is the bardic name of William Thomas. He took the name Islwyn from the parish, and he also lived in Ynysthie. And during his lifetime, he was a well-respected poet locally and nationally, and a bit of a local treasure. So, from the Western Mail in 1874. On the 12th instance, the gorse on Graig Rossa near Ynysthie was set fire to by a mischievous schoolboy who applied to it ignited lucifer matches. In a short time, nearly the whole of the space covered with gorse was in a blaze, and the flames, spreading with alarming rapidity, presented a vast sheet of glaring fire, so terrific in sight that one of the eyewitnesses declared it was awful grand. The adjoining extensive plantation belonging to Mr. Matthew Mogridge was threatened with imminent and utter destruction, as were also several neighbouring houses, one of which being the pretty residence of the respected and talented Christian bard Islwyn. And such most probably would have been the case, but for the prompt and heroic conduct of Mr. Henry Bailey of Ynysthie. Bailey, being apprehensive of the approaching danger, in an instant proceeded to stem the fiery tide. With remarkable sagacity and foresight, he ignited a wide row of gorse at a short distance from the plantation, and kept the flames from nearing the wood, towards which the other fire was advancing, and by this means the approaching fire was effectually subdued. Bailey thereby was the means of saving from utter destruction a vast amount of property. He really deserves the cordial thanks of the community, as well as handsome remuneration from the owners of the said properties for his willing, disinterested and effectual efforts in an emergency of no small magnitude. I wonder if he ever did get the handsome remuneration. Hopefully he got the cordial thanks anyway. Well done, Grandad. And it's hard not to feel that we're going to see more and more hillside wildfires as the years go on and the climate continues to change. Well, it's been a strange part of the journey, and the start of the uplands seems to have repulsed my advance as much as it repulsed the Romans and the Normans. I'm pretty sure, though, that Rambler has found her way through, whether that be along the ridges or down by the river, or on hidden paths that she knows, past brambles and bracken, and she's moving on into the west of the county, deeper into autumn. And so there's nothing for me to do but follow. And I will. And I'll see you again on down the track.